Welcome to Light on Conspiracies, the place where truth and love transcend the darkness. Your host, Peace Award-winning researcher, Ole Damagod. To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe.
I used to chat to animals, almost like a little bit of Dr. Doolittle kind of version, but without them chatting to me back in so many words. But I used to understand what they were trying to communicate to me.
I'm here today with my beautiful friend Jytte Fredholm Ferreira, who at this point in time is one of the people I think that I hope will share a lot of inspiration and passion and show us how to follow their dreams. Because I think at this point in history where so much is to turn upside down, where there's so many challenges and so it's more important than ever that we, each individual, try and find out why are we here? What is the reason we're alive? And so Jytte is living her life as a way forward, I would say, because she is one, if I've ever met anyone who's following her dreams and passion, she is the one. She's an animal communicator, an animal photographer, and also the author of this incredible book. I mean, one of the most beautiful books I've ever seen. It's called The Heart of the Soul, and it's photos of animals in Africa mostly, where she lives. But not just ordinary photos. These are photos where you can feel the soul of these animals. And so I hope that these hours we're going to spend together will inspire and also, for one thing, show how to follow your dreams, but also show how we can help the animals because they are part of the brutal agenda aimed at these creatures. And I really want to do everything I can to support them in any way we can and get this world back in balance. So with all of that said, I say welcome so much, Jytte, to this show.
Thank you very much, Ole. That was a wonderful introduction.
I had the incredible privilege of meeting you in your home in Cape Town in South Africa. And for me, it was very inspiring to meet a fellow soul that are following her dharma, that is really doing the whatever she's meant to do here. So could you please give our viewers a little bit of your background and also tell us how you came to this point in your life?
Right, so we can really start from the beginning then. As a child, I was passionate about all animals and all life, really. And I had a dream to work with animals and to help and protect. I wanted to be close to them. And one of my absolute favorite people of all times was Diane Fossey, who used to work with the gorillas in Rwanda in the jungles of the Virunga Mountains. And I saw a film with her called Gorillas in the Mist, which really gripped my heart even as a child. And I thought, I want to do what she does. I want to work with them, be with them, whichever animal that I choose to work with. And very early in life, I realized I had a very special connection with animals. And it was like I could kind of sense and feel what they felt, and I knew what they were thinking. And, you know, as a child, you don't really question much. You just take it for granted that that's just natural how it is. And so I used to chat to animals, almost like a little bit of Dr. Doolittle kind of version, but without them chatting to me back in so many words. But I used to understand what they were trying to communicate to me. And then obviously later on, I grew up and did a lot of other things in life, you know, and voice became more important than ants and things like that. Led me on many different paths through my young adulthood. Until I eventually ended up in Africa. I met my husband in 1992 in South Africa. I was out there doing a film shoot. We were going to do a documentary about great white sharks. And Craig was at the time the director of operations for White Shark Research Institute. And very fascinating work. there was a great need at the time for the great white shark to be protected. As it was an endangered species, it was severely hunted and the population was nearly depleted. There was no adults and no young of the year, no adults able to reproduce, should I say, and no young of the year having been seen for several years. Because a great white shark takes up to 15 years to reach sexual maturity. Then they carry their young, they give birth to live young, and then they leave them. So when they are born, they're about a meter big. Now, none of those had been seen for several years, which indicated a very serious problem with the population. And at the moment, Craig was busy with a population dynamic study. That means that you do sex and sighting and movement and abundance of the great white sharks along the whole southern African coastline to establish what the population really was looking like. And it was a serious problem. So at the time, the government of South Africa decided, okay, let's give them a break. Let's protect them at least temporarily to see what happens. And that's when I came into the picture. At the time, I felt that we should start some serious awareness and educational program to increase the public awareness of what was really going on. So we started international lecture tours and we started a membership program for great white sharks that became the largest shark conservation and education program in the world at the time. And subsequently, we started changing the public outlook on great white sharks and on other sharks. And it was very powerful because we hit it from all angles. It was TV, radio, newsletters, lecture tours. It was from every angle, schools, whatever we could do. And I can quite happily say that today, the great white shark, nearly 25 years later, the great white shark is in a very safe space, at least in South Africa, and it's not an endangered species anymore. It is still protected and it is now regarded as a resource that is worth more alive than dead, which is a very, very important issue because around the great white shark is now a tourism industry. And when an animal is more worth alive than dead, that's when you can reach really big things with protecting them. Because if there is a bigger value to the animal being dead, then people will kill them. And obviously also the laws are very severe. If you do end up poaching a great white shark, it's a jail sentence and it's quite severe fines, etc. So in any case, so that's basically where I started off in Africa. I went down, I joined my husband and I joined him on the research on the boat. I joined him with the conservation program and from there it progressed and my passion for photography really took speed. I got myself a decent camera at the time. I mean, the DSLR cameras wasn't like really the thing of the time, but it was slowly coming in. And I started doing a lot of trips into Africa with my family, with Craig and the kids.
Can we go back to the shark a little bit? It's like there's so much in your life I want to hear about, so let's take it in parts. This thing with the sharks and their risky situation, how much is that due to this film, Jaws, do you think?
Very, very big, I should say. Jaws was very guilty when it came to portraying the great white shark as the devil, the man-eating devil of the deep, really. The thing is that it portrayed the sharks as all they do is swim around and look for people to eat, and they'll turn boats upside down just to get them. And this this put a complete and utter fear into people. And unfortunately, it didn't stay with the great white shark as such. It became a general fear for sharks. Whereas people might not have worried too much about sharks before that, now it became a big deal. And basically all sharks are better dead than alive in the public eye. And a big witch hunt of great white sharks took place around the world, really, just to get them out and to catch them as trophies and to show how brave you were to be able to catch such a crazy creature. And meantime, it's really just the big fish doing what they need to do to survive, and they don't really eat people unless they have to, unless you're in the right place at the wrong time. But generally, great white sharks don't eat people, and they don't look for people. And usually it's a case of mistaken identity. When somebody is killed by a great white shark, it's usually because they are splashing on the surface. The great white shark is not sure exactly what's going on, and they go and investigate. And an investigatory bite from a great white shark is very damaging. So it can sever your leg and or your torso or whatever, and you'll bleed to death. And that is usually the reason for the death in a shark attack, not that you're actually consumed.
The thing is, they don't have hands and fingers to feel. They feel everything with their mouth.
That's right. That's what they do. They can't do anything else. So when they're not sure, and I mean, if it had been a smaller shark, it would have been a small bite and the person would survive. But great white sharks are generally quite big. Mm-hmm. You know, they can get up to 6 meters. So it's a very, very big animal. And as they grow longer, they also grow bigger this way. So they become like small whales, really, with a very big jaw. So if you end up in their path and they want to check you out, then you're going to get into trouble.
Yeah. You know, I met this incredible woman some many years ago, Samantha Curie, who was the first animal communicator I ever met. And she told the story about how she was very lonely as a child and going through a difficult time, childhood and so on. And the only friend she had was her dog.
Mm.
She had this communication with the dog without knowing that that was something unusual.
Mm.
And it was first when she started growing up and when she was an adult that she started seeing that, oh my God, everybody doesn't do that. I thought this was normal. And then she started more and more exploring that way into a way of helping animals and starting to see what was going on, and with incredible results. And also with the aim of creating heaven on earth, Eden, the Garden of Eden, where everything is in balance and peace and loving understanding in her own home and garden and so on. When you were a child, was it through suffering that you came to this point, or was it just very natural to you the way that you started seeing that there was a communication between you and the animals?
It definitely wasn't through suffering. It was actually pure love and passion for the nature. And I remember as a very young child, probably about 6 or 7, I used to spend my summers at my grandparents' place. And there was a little forest. And in the little forest was a big ant heap. And there was a path where they walk in thousands. And in Sweden in summer, the sun rises at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I used to get up really early and I used to walk out on this little path because it was so peaceful and beautiful. It was between two lakes, this little path. And I used to walk there, and I was talking naturally to the ants, and I said, well, you know, if I put my feet here on the ground, you won't bite me and I won't step on you. And for some odd reason, they moved aside every time I put my feet down. So I never stepped on them, and they never bit me. Mind you, I was walking in a path with thousands of ants. And it was like an immediate communication. And then I thought, well, I'm chatting to them. You know, it was very strange. And that's when I realized that I could kind of communicate with it doesn't matter the size of the animal. Every animal has got a presence and an instinctive knowledge of life and death and an energy that they exert that you can pick up. And even ants have. I mean, I've got some fun experiences from home when I'm talking to my ants and asking them to please leave my kitchen. And they eventually, after putting them out one by one, they eventually get a little bit cheesed off with me, and they go and they have a conference in the kitchen, in the window sill. Like in a big ring, they're standing talking because they like my kitchen because it's good food. And I don't want them there because they're running around all over the place. So it takes normally a few weeks for them to understand that I'm serious. But once I've told them enough times, they actually do leave. And you...
Samantha also, she was talking about ants. And she showed us a trick which we used when we were living on Mallorca, because the ants are really a problem here in Spain sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
So what she said was, make a deal with them. You say, I will feed you. I will put sugar out in that spot in the garden every day if you promise to leave my house alone. And if you will not leave, you have to understand there will be war. And she communicates in the images, not in words, it's always with images. She says, and she says, just picture them, you know, with a horrible spray and them going, and then picture them with the food you put out there, how happy they're going to be, and do it like that. And when we moved to Mallorca many years ago, we had this massive invasion of ants. I mean, it was ridiculous. Like the whole wall was just filled with them. And so the neighbors had the same. We just had the Spanish neighbors in the area. And so Kim started, my sweetheart Kim, she started putting sugar out in the garden, and the ants left. With a bit of help with cinnamon that made them, they do not like cinnamon. So that also helped. And our neighbors was like, oh, come on, you have to be kidding me. You know, they were buying all of these big spray cans and the ants would just keep coming. And he was making fun of us. And so the ants left our house and instead went to his house. Anyway, I think in the end that he started putting sugar out in the garden as well, because I think he managed. So we've never had ant spray or anything like that. We deal with it like
I actually do something similar. I usually put out some jam, you know. You check out where they come in, because usually they come from the outside somewhere, and you will find a little ant path up along your wall or whatever. So you'll put the jam at the bottom on the ground, and they won't have a reason to actually enter your house in the first place. So that is a very effective sugar or jam or anything sweet that they like. It's a very good way of doing it. But sometimes you don't actually know where they come from. And then talking to them and communicating, saying, listen, guys, it's time that you move out.
Do you know, a few times both Kim and I have spent like 3 day and nights alone on a mountain somewhere, you know, just in silence, where we sit, no books, no music, no nothing. We're not allowed. It's our own rules, but you're not allowed to walk around. You're just there, sitting, watching the sky, watching the sun, and ants. I tell you, when you sit 3 days in the same spot, the ants become extremely interesting. And so I spent many hours just watching ants and what they're doing and how many you can feed with just a little piece of melon or whatever. It's incredible. And the joy of sharing also, because you see the ants are like, yay, baby, check out what I just found, you know, when you put a piece of melon. And
They're amazing little creatures. They're hardworking little creatures, and they do everything as a community, and they strive and they fight for the lives of their community to survive, and they carry such heavy things for such long distances. It's just an amazing little creature. And I really feel for them, and I think they're very cute, you know.
They are. I think so too. I really like them. And grasshoppers, and here we have, I don't know what they're called. They look like grasshoppers, but they are this size. What are they called? They're like fluorescent green, but then they change.
What are they called? I can't get enough.
But we have them here in the south of Spain, and they're just absolutely incredible. There was this guy sitting out there. I picked him up, and then we were holding hands. I held his little hand, or her hand, I'm not sure, and we were just looking at each other. It was just like this amazing experience, because the way I see it, people say, oh, maybe there's going to be an alien invasion. But if you look at these ones, I mean, they are aliens.
They really are. They look amazing.
They do.
But you know that the female eats the male, hey?
Well, what else is new?
You know what they do? They look for a male, and they're all like making themselves pretty and attractive, and then the guy comes and he fertilizes them, and then like once she's finished with that, then he's done his job and she eats him. Oh God. I think that would be a pity if people did that, because men are nice, so you want them around. You don't want to eat them. At least not alive.
Maybe you can hear our rooster in the background. His name is Rocco, by the way. He wants to join the conversation, it sounds like. No, but so hopefully it was a male that I was holding hand with, because otherwise the stare, or with the way it was looking at me, was maybe different. Listen, tell me a bit more about Craig, how you met, and I mean, because he's not just anyone either. I mean, that is a colorful individual.
Oh, yes, indeed, he is. We did meet first time when I came out to do the film with about Great White Sharks in South Africa. I came out with the Swedish film crew, and as I said, he was the operations manager, and very fascinating man, very knowledgeable. He's probably the greatest expert on great white sharks in the world today, and he's featured in numerous movies and documentaries today. And a very strong character, definitely. And I found him fascinating when we met. And he obviously felt the same way about me, because it wasn't long after that we got married. And I moved down and to him, and we started working together.
I know I've heard stories that sound a bit like Crocodile Dundee coming to Sweden.
It was like that, yeah, and then we actually did get married in Sweden, and when he came out here for the first time, he was really a wild African man, that not used to proper civilization like we used to here in Sweden. And he came here and he was fighting with everything, all electric doors and everything, everywhere he went. It was like, what's going on here? And it was fighting, trying to open everything, and this ticket system in the banks and stuff, he didn't understand that. He would walk up to a counter and he would say, like, yes. And they would say, go and take a ticket. So he would go back and take a ticket and come back. And they would say, no, you have to wait in the queue. And he says, where's the queue? It was very funny. I had many good laughs because it was very crazy. And, you know, like in South Africa, we don't really have a lot of central heating and stuff. So when it's cold outside, it's reasonably cold inside, but in Sweden it's like can be 20 minus outside and 20 plus inside. And he would think like, oh, but it's sun shining and it looks nice outside. So he will walk out barefoot going down to 7-Eleven and it's minus 15 degrees. And he only realizes that after being walking for certain amounts of time. It's like, shit, it's cold here. And then locking himself out of the codes of the buildings, and anyway, it was a very crazy time for him. I was just standing by watching and laughing.
I think it's really funny.
Who did I actually marry?
I think it's really funny also that this guy who's an expert with the great white shark has a massive problem with mosquitoes, with Swedish mosquitoes. I mean, the tiniest, tiny little creature.
Yeah, he doesn't. He's crazy. Well, he's crazy about them, but great white sharks is no problem. Mm.
So you say you just happened to come to South Africa as a photographer. I totally doubt that, because I mean, there must have been massive steps from a normal so-called life until you ended up in South Africa like that. With your spirit of adventure, I'm sure you've been to multiple countries before that and so on. Could you give us a little bit of your more about that background?
Sure. Yeah, obviously it wasn't just to get up and go to Africa first step. I mean, I left Sweden actually quite young. I was only 19 when I left Sweden, and I moved to Greece where I studied, and then I moved from there. I moved around basically for 10 years studying and working in Greece, in England, in Japan, in Holland. And then I returned to Sweden for a short space of time, and that's when this whole thing was going to Africa. My mother had in the meantime moved to Africa in the 80s, or to South Africa, and I'd been down to see her several times and felt totally in love with South Africa at the time, and decided that this is a good place to live. So I was a regular visitor down there. And that's how it all came about. A friend of mine, a Swedish girlfriend, she said to me, why don't we go and dive with the great white sharks? So I said, sure, let's do that. This was in 1992. And at the time, there was no great white shark diving done in South Africa, but we didn't know that. And it was really only Ron and Valerie Taylor in Australia that was doing that kind of activity. So we were searching and we couldn't find anywhere to do it because nobody was doing it. And then eventually we got hold of the White Shark Research Institute, and then we said to them, you know, we would like to go diving. And they were like, yeah, but sorry, we don't work with the public like that. We're a research organization. We work with scientists and film crews only. So then we said, okay, well, we managed to convince Craig, which I spoke to on the phone at the time, that maybe if they got a little gap, they could still take us out. And he said, well, maybe. And as it turned out, we never managed to get out with them, but I went back to Sweden, set up a film crew because I had some friends that were in the film industry and adventure industry combined. So together, we decided this is a great way of getting down there and seeing some great white sharks and making a movie out of it. So that's what we did. So in 1993, we came down to film.
I mean, 1993, that was after Nelson Mandela had been released. The whole apartheid shift was in the move. And so how did you experience these things at that time?
Well, you know, at the time, I mean, I started going to South Africa in the late 80s. And I mean, it wasn't until the real election and the ANC took over in 1994 that you really saw any major changes. And I mean, South Africa was, this has always been a country of beauty, and you never experienced the public view that was portrayed overseas around the world about the hate between blacks and whites. You never, that wasn't in the experience that I ever had traveling around in South Africa in the 80s either. People were extremely friendly, people got on. Blacks were working in the shops, whites were working in the shops, people were working together in offices. So it was a kind of a normal feeling. You didn't have the feeling of segregation and separation because for quite a long time, I think it had been starting to even out, you know, and all these like white beaches and black beaches and that were all gone by then. So I never really experienced that. I think maybe today there is more apartheid than ever on the reverse side of the coin, where whites actually got less rights today than a black person. And that has got to do with the black economic empowerment and the government wanting to raise the greater part of the population up to an acceptable economic level, which is then to the detriment of the people that have education and want to do other things. So it's not an ideal situation. It's a difficult situation because you want both. You want everybody to have the same rights, obviously, and everybody to have the same opportunities.
It feels to me like there's a lot of payback karma to deal with, because I don't know, maybe people didn't really understand what you said, but now it's sort of turned around that there's a white underclass almost that are being treated almost like in apartheid. The color of your skin is against you if you're white. Chances of you getting a job is a lot less if you're white, and so on. So the whole thing has turned around.
It is like that, unfortunately.
When do you think we will be able to see a balance, a natural balance between black and white?
I don't know. Maybe 50 years, maybe. I don't know. It's going to be a long time. There is an underlying hate, I think, that has been recreated again. It was kind of fading away when we still had Nelson Mandela as our president, because he was very much for the love of all kinds, and the rainbow nation was his ideal. And today, that is not the case anymore. Now it really has turned against the white people. And the sad thing is that the people that are growing up today have got absolutely nothing to do with apartheid. They never known it. They were born in a time where there isn't apartheid. So people don't understand why they are being segregated, and they don't have the same rights as everybody else. And now we're talking about young white people. It's very difficult for a young white person to get a job in South Africa today.
This whole mentality and dream of Nelson Mandela, has that just totally faded out? Or are there any other individuals that are coming up with the same philosophy and background?
Look, in the ANC, definitely not. Nelson Mandela's ideal has faded away, and it faded away while he was still alive. And he was very sad about that. And many times he actually stood up against the current government and said, you know, guys, this is not the way that we were meant to do things. And they basically just told him to shut up because he's not the president anymore. He's got nothing to say about it. And now the only person you have left with any kind of power that still promotes a real and true equality of human beings is really Desmond Tutu, which is our Archbishop. And he's very old now. He's 90, past his 90s. And, you know, he's getting tired and he's not 100% well. So he's kind of stepping back from the public view, and it's really sad. But he's also been told to be quiet quite a few times. And so it isn't ideal, and I think it'll take a long time. I think South Africa has to take a real dive and crash before it will come up again. I don't know. It's hard to see when you're there because it's such a beautiful country, and everything seems very nice on the surface, and everything is working, and there's a lot of international investments going on in the country, and so you kind of get the feeling that it's going forward. But somewhere it's like in the back of that, it's going down. And a lot of people with education and they're leaving the country.
It's very sad to see, I think, because it seemed so beautiful when Mandela was really moving forward. One thing I noticed when we were there, I mean, we traveled around, not so much, but some, and I never, ever saw white and black sitting at the same table, driving in the same vehicles. I don't know if that was just a coincidence, but I mean, this natural mix of colors that you see in other countries, I did not notice there.
But I think that has got its natural explanations. That it's not necessarily got to do with the color. It's got more to do with cultural differences. Mm. You know, it's like you socialize with the ones that are like yourself. So in South Africa, the black population, they've got a totally and utterly different culture to the whites. The whites are European whites, and we're all pretty similar in Europe, whereas the black culture is vastly different. It's an African culture, and you don't really have that much in common, and subsequently you don't really socialize unless you have a black population now that are growing up in the cities, away from their traditional cultures, and they have been to universities and things. There you see a lot of mix between the races. And it's not the color. Mm. It's the culture that separates people, I think, in South Africa.
You have traveled around in a lot of different African countries. Are there big major differences between these countries, or is it the same situation there as well?
It's a big difference, actually. I think a lot of African countries have been traumatized by Europeans and in the past, you know, with colonialism, etc. But many have not. And a country like, for instance, Botswana, which is one of my favorite countries, I love it there, not only for the wildlife, but also for the people being so completely at ease with other races. They don't have an issue. They don't care what color you are. They actually don't care at all because they don't have a chip on their shoulder or an issue with the past. So they just normal, you know, like we would be here. They're very nice. I went to Rwanda, to Uganda, to Kenya. I've been in the whole, basically, sub-Saharan Africa, mostly. And I find that even in a place like Rwanda that has gone through such major trauma, not now necessarily the last one between whites and blacks, but between blacks and blacks, but the reason behind that, the history behind that, was the cause of the whites. And the domination of Belgium, of Rwanda for a long time. But they still don't have that negativity and hate towards white people. Although white people has been there controlling that country for a long time in the past. I mean, you have countries like Zimbabwe, which got a lot of issues, but in the general population, you don't really feel anything either. It's the government that's got issues there, not the people. So it is different. It is different, definitely.
You've been listening to the first hour of A Light on Conspiracies podcast. To access the second hour of this and all podcasts, please visit lightonconspiracies.com and get a membership for the price of a cup of coffee. Now, back to the show.
Yeah, and also what is very sad to see is like when the white power sort of leave these countries and the power is given to the black population, these countries often go straight down financially and structure. And so it's like how to do it, how to deal with it in a good way. And also, I know now that in South Africa, there's quite a concern about a lot of murders on farmers and some white farmers and so on. Is that something that is ongoing?
Yeah, definitely ongoing. There is an underlying brewing hate that has been revived through politics, which is really sad because it could have just as well gone the other way, and we could have been a nation with reasonable peace at the moment, but we're not. We're really not.
So how do you feel? I know you're in Sweden now, but how do you feel about going back now? I think you're leaving in a few weeks.
I love my country. I love South Africa. I love it there. I love the people. I find the mixture between all the races that we have in South Africa very stimulating. And it's definitely not a mediocre life that you lead there. There is something that happens on a daily basis. Sometimes it's really positive and sometimes it's really negative. And then you for sure realize that you're alive every day. Here you can kind of predict what's going to happen in 3 months' time, and you can even set a meeting. I'll meet you at Carlucci's Cafe in 3 months' time at 10 o'clock. You know, you just don't do that in South Africa because you make the meeting 3 days before maybe. You know, it's just how it is. It's because everything is very fluctuating. Things change all the time, and there's always some drama going on somewhere in life, and it makes you feel alive. And although it's not always positive, I love the feeling of being alive. It keeps me going and it stimulates me. So I like it. I love it there. And I love Africa as a continent. It's the most amazing continent. I love it. Everything about it. I love the people. I love the music. I love the culture. I love the spontaneity of the black cultures, the freedom that they have of dance and sing and laughter that just comes out of their bodies, you know, whether they want it or not. It's just there, and I find it very beautiful.
How would you explain the word inspiration, and how should it be used?
That's an interesting question. Inspiration, well, you know, there are different ways of inspiration, I think. I think you can find inspiration in various things in life. You can find inspiration through your work when you get stimulated and you get challenged to reach other heights. You can also find inspiration, I find, in nature. For me, I find inspiration in nature, in the incredible beauty and the intricacy of life itself. That to me is very inspiring. To live who you are and to try to find a path in your life where you feel inspired because you're following your heart and you're doing something that creates love inside of you. That's very inspiring to me.
For me, I say, you know, follow your goosebumps. Whatever gives you goosebumps, that is almost like a GPS. That the way I see it or understand these things that are so big that I have no clue really what's going on. But it's almost like in this myriad of different ways that you can walk through life, whatever gives you goosebumps, it's like a GPS that is saying the reason you came here is over here. It's here you should go. You can choose whatever way you want to go, but this is the one. And I think the goosebumps are guiding you. And this is where in Spiritus, when body and mind align, spirit enters, that I think is where we will find guidance towards where whatever we are supposed to do here. And because I think it's so incredible to ask people what their passions are, what they get inspired of. Because it's anything from, I want to be a baker, I want to be a carpenter, I want to be lazy, whatever it is that inspires you. Yeah. I mean, but it's like, this is the thing that is helping to say, shape you into becoming who you really are. And this is what I find very inspiring with you, is that you have really been searching that thing inside you and following that GPS in your heart that has showed you a very different way. How does it feel to live like that?
It is incredible. It's very fulfilling to be able to live your love, you know, to live with what you love the most. For me, animals and nature is the most important thing on earth. And of course, I love my family and I love people, but it's not as important as the bigger picture of nature and life itself. And I just find that no matter where you look and whatever you look at, it's so incredibly intricate and so incredibly beautiful when it is life itself, the way that it's being created in one way or another. And to be able to be with animals that are innocent, there is no negativity, no evil, no, there is only love. And nature is only love. And I just find that so incredibly inspiring to be in an environment where that is the presence of everything. To be able to share that also with the world is I want everybody to feel what I feel. I would like everybody to be able to experience and to appreciate that every little fly. I know you don't even like the flies. You've been smacking it away in your face.
You're welcome, but please don't interfere at this point.
No, I'm just kidding. But to be able to really see the beauty and enjoy it, because it is so rewarding and fulfilling. And with my photography, I'm hoping to share and to draw people into a different world and a different appreciation of what I see.
When I saw this photo, when we were talking about your book and you were mentioning these lions, and also your features are like a lioness, a very beautiful lioness, and there was something in your eyes that was just like, boom, that was pure passion around these lions. So can you tell us a little bit about your love for lions?
You've really hit it on the spot there, because it almost sounds like a cliche. Everybody loves lions, but I really do love them. I feel their spirit very strongly in me. It's like I pick up their spirit and I feel like I'm one of them. And when I'm out photographing them, it's like an incredible connection that I have with them. And the things they say and the things they exert, the power, the dominance over life and death in a humble way, the physical power and the mental calmness, and it is all totally and utterly absorbing to me. I go a week in my knees when I get close to them, because I love them so much. I really do. It's something I can't really explain, but it fills my whole body and my soul, and I feel like I'm taking on a different frequency when I'm around them.
They say they're the kings of the animal kingdom. Do you agree with that?
I do. Look, there are many kings in this world, but the lions, definitely out of the predators, I would say they're definitely the kings and the queens.
I changed into royalties because I heard that it didn't sound. So this, when an individual has that force to be able to decide life or death for someone else, like the lions have, I mean, they can very easily just, and that's it, you're dead. When you are in their presence, how do they communicate that? How can they show us how we should deal with that type of power among ourselves and others?
I think that in all animal kingdom, animals don't take any more than what they need, which is a very important factor here. With humans, we have greed, and people always want more than they need, and they take more than they need. And money rules the world. In the animal kingdom, the only thing that rules is pure survival, and you will never take more than you need. And people think that certain animals are wasteful, etc. But I don't agree with that. There is always an explanation why animals do certain things. And usually it's a very logical and acceptable explanation. And I find that lions live in a beautiful community where they look after each other. They look after their young incredibly well. They share their responsibilities. They are very, very affectionate. They show so much love, and they really are enjoyers of life. Have you ever seen a lion just lying on their back enjoying, and like, and one of the others licking the throat? And it's like, that is pure enjoyment in life. That is like taking in the love and just living. And that is something that we should do. We should enjoy each other. We should enjoy love. We should enjoy kindness and sharing, and only take what we need. I think it's a very good lesson to be learned.
I know your son, your oldest son, Storm, he came with you on a trip to, I think, Botswana, one of the neighboring countries. And he was like, it sounds so interesting. Oh, we're going on a safari. Oh, but he said, these lions, they're just lying around for hours and hours doing absolutely nothing. But you were so into it because you were looking for something totally different, and you were in a totally different frequency together with them somehow. But What is it that makes the difference?
You know what? I think it's obviously for somebody like Storm or anybody else, they will drive up to a lion and they'll look at them and they'll think, wow, that's a beautiful animal. But because they don't have that intense passion and interest that I have, I love every little movement they make. If they lie with their eyes closed, then they will eventually open their one eye and they will look around. That's a way of their behavior. They will rise up and they will do things. If you just give them time, they will move around and they will interact. But you've got to give them time. I mean, you can't learn anything about any animal by just watching them for 5 minutes. You might need 5 hours or 5 days or 5 months to understand what they're really doing. And because I'm interested in animal behavior and in what they really feel and do and how they live, for me, every second spent with them, it's passion for me. I don't care if they sleep. They don't sleep very deep. They just close their eyes and they will breathe and they will come flies and they will suddenly get up. And when they get up, they will interact with the others. They will walk past one and they will lick something, or they will look around, they'll hear sounds. And so there is always movement and interest. They don't just ever just lie, although people think so, but that's not what they do.
Have they ever communicated anything about their current situation to you, about the difficulties?
Lions are interesting in that way because they seem to be very much in their presence of being the rulers of their environment, of life and death, and they're very calm and very unthreatened. Unless obviously there is a specific situation where they are hunted or something, but they don't seem to take on the worry as much as many of the other animals do in the same way. I haven't really, they often communicate, and they communicate the interest, acceptance, love. They often communicate what they feel about their families. And whereas gorillas and elephants, and they often communicate about their worries about the world around them, which I don't really pick up from the lions as well. It's almost like they don't really give a damn, but they do. They do, but it's almost like they are above it in a way.
But real,
if you can understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. So what kind
slightly of arrogant. A little bit like, well, you know, they're not arrogant, but it's an attitude that.
But it's more that they know their magnificence. Isn't it more like that?
They do. They do know their magnificence. And of course they worry, but they worry more about their current situation in, you know, about feeding their young and hunting. They're not so interactive into the world, I feel, into the human world. as many of the other animals.
You feel a difference when it comes to elephants around this and gorillas?
Yeah, definitely. Elephants are very communicative animals, and they often express emotions and they express worries. They also have memories, and therefore if they've had bad experiences, they can bring it up. It can come up in them as sadness and that sort of thing, which you don't really find in the lion. And the same with gorillas. They are also very sensitive, very aware of the outside world in a different way.
I've never seen sadness in the eyes of a lion, but in the eyes of an elephant, all the time.
Yeah. It's not that the lions don't understand. It's just that their priorities are different, I think.
But isn't it a bit like also when you just watch a normal cat, and they are like, you're going like, kissy-missy, come here. I mean, no way will they come if they don't feel like coming. And also they will show you sort of like, you are allowed to admire me now when I sit in this pose. You can admire me from this angle as well because I'm magnificent. And there's nothing insulting. It's just the way it is. And then they show you their teeth, you know, this is my power. You see the exact same thing with the lions, and they're just
That's right. Cats are actually different. Cats are cats.
I think really they're masters in their way of be able to relax and chill and enjoy and play, and I think they're absolute masters.
And they are.
Also meditate. They're so into their why do you think they sleep like 18 hours a day? Is that true that they do that? And if so, what do they do? Are their dreams very important, you think, for what is going on?
I think they do it because it just feels good. I mean, they hunt for the rest. They eat, they hunt, and they feed their young, and the rest, they lie around and enjoy life. And they let their food digest and you know, they recover from the hunt, and then they prepare themselves for the next time. So they're recovering and they're simply enjoying, I think. They are life enjoyers. They really know how to take advantage of good life.
So how often do they have to eat?
You know, they're opportunistic feeders, lions. So normally they don't have to eat every day, and they usually don't. They can eat every third day, for instance, or depending on the size prey that they caught, like the day before. If they caught an impala, then it's not going to be enough to keep them full for long. Whereas if they caught a buffalo, they can eat it for several days. So it depends how often they hunt, really, and how big the pride is to feed. But if they have just caught something, and it does happen that something will walk past and the opportunity is just there, and they will whack that too, just, you know, because they will eat it within the next couple of days. But you're more safe walking past as a creature, obviously a well-fed lion, than a lion that is hungry. But they do still go for the other animal, even if they have got a kill already. It happens.
Have you ever felt threatened by a lion?
No. I just feel very fulfilled when I'm in their near. I've never felt threatened. I wouldn't just walk up to any odd lion and you know, that wouldn't be a normal thing to do, because they are wild animals and they have their own space and they are hunters. So before I come close to them in any way, I like to communicate and get an acceptance of my presence, that they actually want me there and that they are okay with me taking photographs of them and being in their space, in their very tight community of energy, without taking something away from them that they don't want to be taken away. So it's a very nice feeling when you get included in their space, and that's also maybe why I can just sit there for hours and hours and hours without a problem. I sometimes just want to go and lie next to them, but I don't know if that's a good idea. Maybe that's the next step.
Yeah. I would go for it if it feels right, I tell you.
Well, my family don't really agree.
I can understand that. Do you think that they have an understanding of why you're there, what you're trying to do?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because I communicate that to them. I practice what we call interspecies communication, which is a technique based on electromagnetic vibrations. You exchange basically thoughts. You know, every thought has got a vibration, an energy. And the animals don't know the language we speak, but they understand the energy, so just as we do. And so, you know, for instance, with a dog, you can communicate with a dog without knowing the language of the dog. I mean, you might not be able to tell him to sit, but you'll be able to communicate many other things on an energetic level. And the same way you do with the animals in the wild, you communicate on an energetic level. And so your thoughts and your feelings are transformed into different energetic frequencies, which the animals pick up. So it's basically the same thing as telepathy. You know, it is instant. It doesn't really matter where you are, although it's always easier when you are in the presence of the creature, because it's a direct connection, not only energetically, but also visually. And then you can exchange information with that animal. You can tell them what you want. You can tell them why you're there. And you can ask them things you want to know. You can ask them if there are specific things they actually want to communicate to you. And sometimes there isn't, and sometimes there is. And sometimes they're just happy that you're there. And most wild animals are actually quite happy to have you in their presence once you have achieved that energetic connection with them. And most of them do have some things to say, which is very interesting, and they like it, because you are a channel into a world that doesn't listen normally. Mm-hmm. You know, you can relay messages. Mm-hmm. Whales and elephants and gorillas and things, they're often very communicative, and they got things to say, messages they want us to take with us and spread, you know, warnings about destruction of the earth. And they are very aware of what's happening in our environment. And they're warning us and asking us to please take heed, you know, and do something. So it's very interesting.
Listen, Jytte, we're coming to the end of the first hour. Could you please tell people how they can contact you, support you in what you want to achieve, and also how to get hold of your incredible book here that I really personally want to recommend highly, highly, highly. This is so much than just an ordinary book. It's just not photos, the whole thing, everything from the quality of the paper to the selection of photos, to what photos have been picked, because these are like spiritual photos. They're not just like, here's an animal with four legs and a head. Absolutely not. These are just incredible, incredible images. So could you please share some information about that?
I would think that the best way to contact me would be to go through my website, or contact me via my email, my direct email, which is, do you want me to say that now?
Please do.
So it's visionaliveimages@gmail.com. So it's visionaliveimages@gmail.com. That's one way of contacting me, and I will always respond to that very quickly. Another way to get in touch with me is going into my website, having a look. I got a lot of pictures there. Not all my pictures are there, because sometimes I don't have time to upload stuff all the time, but there is a lot of stuff there. And there's also, you can order the book there through me. You can also order pictures there if you want. There are some pictures for sale on that. And I also give lectures and things. So talks about what I do, and talks about inspiration, talks about living your passion, etc. And that can also, you can also contact me and just ask me what you would like, and then I will respond.
And your website again, the address?
That is www.visionaliveimages.com.
Excellent. Excellent. In the second hour, I want to talk more about how to deal with fear, how to see what is your real passion, find out what is the thing that you're supposed to do, and also hear more about your travels and the way you see the future. So thank you so much for this first hour.
Thank you. Look forward to it.
To listen to this full interview, just go to lightonconspiracies.com and subscribe. Give yourself the gift of truth and awareness while supporting Ole's hard efforts to get it out there.
Coup d'etat in slow motion. Connecting the dots between the assassinations of Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme, JFK, Robert Kennedy, and John Lennon. Now available on Amazon and lightonconspiracies.com. Coup d'etat in slow motion.
May the entire universe be filled with peace and joy, love and light. May everyone, and especially the ones who heard us, be filled with peace and joy, love and light. Victory to that light.